Well, hopefully we will be receiving some of your questions in the next few minutes. I'm going to start the discussion here by asking you this sort of open-ended question, which would be really a follow-up with your ending message. In your opinion, what role can a university like Cal State Monterey Bay play in encouraging sustainable economic growth in our region?
Well, I'm really excited by what CSUMB is, and I'm really excited by the fact that this is a young organization, so that it can change along with the region. And, you know, quite simply put, I think this can be an intellectual and entrepreneurial hub for the rest of the region, and not just, you know, not just technology companies, but also culture. There's so much culture in this region that needs to be pulled together and spread out to the rest of the world. You got a big job in front of you. So do all the rest of you.
In this sort of turbulent era that we're in, looking ahead at the future, what advice would you give to a student just beginning his or her college education?
Well, you're actually about, if you're just starting college, it's a little too late for the main piece of advice I'm going to give you. There was some Stanford parents, and they were asking for advice about their daughter entering. And I said, well, actually, it's too late for that, but I do have suggestions for her little sister, and that is 3 languages and 2 passports. but that aside, I think the advice I would make is something my very good friend David Kelly, who's the founder of the D School at Stanford, likes to talk about. You'll hear David and the rest of us talk a lot about creating T-shaped people. I know you have some T-shaped buildings on campus that have asbestos in it. I'm not talking about those. T-shaped people are people who have broad skill, broad knowledge, and one area they go very deep, deep expertise. And I think that's the secret to success. You have an area that you can go deep in, but you've got that platform of broad expertise so you can move into adjacent spaces. Because, of course, you know, the job, your job that you, first job you have out of school may be a job that doesn't exist when you're a freshman. And, of course, the job that students will be doing 10 years, 20 years from now will be completely different. So I love the interdisciplinary nature of the emphasis here at CSUMB. And I think that's a key way to, you know, be curious, T-shaped people.
You talked about innovation and how myth-making.
You had no idea. He's had these carefully printed questions up here. So I'm hoping there are some questions from the audience because, you know, nothing makes a guest. So you go ahead.
I'm done with those.
I'm just like sweating here thinking, you know. So
Yeah, this one I'm making up on the fly.
Okay.
Which is, in your experience, is a capacity for innovation something that can be taught, that can be included by design in a curriculum or an educational experience for students?
I don't have a good answer to that. And I also, you know, I think we're, this is a moment in time where we're faced by crises and challenges on every point of the compass. And we've had some successes with innovations saving our bacon in a couple of situations. And I fear that we may have too narrow a definition of innovation. And that's one thing where I think CSUMB can play a unique role. We need to broaden this out more. It's not about starting companies or doing a .com. It's not even about technology. It's about culture. It's about change. I mean, I can think of lots of places that need innovation, you know. Happens to be a date that Californians are voting, except Californians are not voting. Democracy feels like it's in need of some innovation. I think that you can teach tools intellectually in your head that help you do the process of innovation, but this has to come out of your heart. This has to come out of the notion that, you know, we must have change. The story I always think about was in the 1950s, you know, the most powerful companies in this country were railroad companies. So powerful that they, you know, beat President Truman back on, you know, when he was trying to block strikes. But it was an interesting moment in time. The railroad companies knew that the Interstate Highway Act had been passed and they're building highways, and gee, that might be an interesting way to carry freight. And they also knew that after World War II, the first airplanes that could carry a lot of passengers were beginning to emerge. I thought, ooh, that might take our most, you know, wealthy, powerful passengers. And so the most visionary among the railroad executives said, gee, we have to stop being railroad companies. We have to innovate. We have to become something else. Let's transform ourselves into transportation companies or sell right away. Or like some of our successes. Remember Sprint? Well, Sprint, the word, the first two letters of Sprint was for Southern Pacific. The Southern Pacific Railroad using right away to do fiber optic cable. So it was some clever things. But the reason why you don't hear much about railroad companies anymore was in their head, they knew they had to change. Intellectually, they knew how to change. But in their heart, they just love choo-choos too much. And so we have to start by admitting that change scares the hell out of us. We love hearing about it and reading about it after the fact. But to really innovate, you have to look deep into your soul and say, am I really willing to change things? Am I willing to make my sacred cows into the best burgers on the peninsula?
Which brings up a question about burgers.
I'm sorry.
From the audience.
Apologies to the vegans. Actually, I like the new Field. If you want a really good vegan burger, there's a brand called Field Roast. I really recommend them. It's a guilty pleasure.
So this is...
No animals were killed in the preparation of this talk.
From the audience, they're asking you for an example from Stanford, an example that might be applicable to a Cal State campus like us. And the question is, which sacred cows in higher ed make the best burgers?
Ooh, that's, you know, that's what a question that, you know, for those of you who drink wine, that's like holding it up and looking at the light and savoring it and rolling it around in your mouth. I'm not sure I have a really good. Well, here's one thing that I've seen at Stanford, and I know it's much the same here. A phrase you'll hear a lot among faculty at Stanford is, it's no longer sage on the stage, it's guide by the side. Mm-hmm. That idea of, you know, the white guy on the stage, as the white guy was just on the stage lecturing. This is an exception to it, but is that the role of teaching is to be the guide by the side of the discovery process. And you do so much of that here as well. So I think Stanford and CSUMB are much on the same page, but is to avoid that notion of, you know, delivering knowledge. This is, in a period of change as rapid as this, this is an exploratory process where, sure, some people are being paid to be professors, but we're all explorers, we're all innovators.
And you've mentioned the importance of failure in order to achieve progress and innovation. What is your favorite failure of your lifetime?
So Frank Keith is in the audience. He could tell you in greater detail. I went to high school here in Monterey, and my kindergarten teacher wanted to hold me back, and there was some question about whether I was going to graduate out of seventh grade. And then I went to a little school on the Monterey Peninsula that changed my life. So I've been pretty good at failing. So it'd be hard to pick a specific instance, but at moments. I mean, the thing about failure, I should say, I'm being a little glib, but you know, at moments you have that. Well, the way to think about failure is Walpole's tale of the Lords of Serendip, out of which the phrase serendipity came. And for those of you who haven't read it, look it up. It's on the web. And it's a story of two brothers, and they go through life, and they are tent makers, and everything's going great, and something happens. They get wiped out, you know, shipwrecked, and they start somewhere else, and they end up doing something else, making ship masts. And I don't want to spoiler alert here, but it ends happy because it turns out that all of the things they learned in their failures become the key pieces for their success at the end of the story. And so viewing failure as the process, now, admittedly, at times, you know, when you get that really bad failure, I mean, I have had those instances. I remember once a dean at my college, and I related the story to him, and he said, "And yes, and that's when your knees turn to jelly." Or as, you know, John Jacob Astor is alleged to have said while sitting in the bar of the SS Titanic, "I know I asked for ice, but this is ridiculous."
Okay, one of our listeners here states, a key person in the creating of the internet recently said that there was no attention given to the dark side of what was being created. Do you see a dark side to the internet? And what about artificial intelligence?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so this was, I think it was Elon Musk who suddenly woke up to the fact that, you know, there's a dark side to all technologies. You know, Heraclitus got this right several thousand years ago when he said, nothing new comes into our lives without a hidden curse. You know, every new thing that comes has a shadow that it casts. And what we're doing with digital technology is vastly powerful. We're performing a great unwitting experiment on ourselves. And we don't know how it's going to turn out. So, yeah, there's lots of dark sides to this. And we have to wrestle with that. On the specific subject of, you know, are we going to get what's called strong AI? So these are artificial intelligences that are smarter than humans and evolving faster than human beings. I'm sort of agnostic on whether that will happen or not, but I do have a forecast of the outcome. So if we really do get superhuman intelligences that evolve faster than us, there are two scenarios. The optimistic scenario is if we're very, very lucky, they will treat us like pets. And if we're very, very unlucky, they will treat us like food.
Okay.
But it ain't gonna happen, don't worry about it. Actually, the real truth is, you know, is this thing called, how many people know what the Turing test is? So Alan Turing posited this test of what he called a class A machine. What people say, well, it's proof of an intelligent machine. So you do this process, and if someone was in a controlled environment, it was, in his case, two teletypewriters, one connected to a human, other connected to a machine, ask any question you want, and if you can't tell the difference between, you know, which one's intelligent or not, then the machine arguably passes the Turing test. The real insight, and of course, we have machines that do better things than us all the time. You know, we had steam shovels replace hand shovels. We have computers that play better chess than we do. And, you know, quick, who can calculate pi out to 10 places in the next 10 seconds? And actually, I'll give you let me finish the ridiculous part, and then I'll give you a serious answer to it. The way the AI question should have been phrased if Elon Musk was smart enough. The fact is, when we finally do have machines that pass the Turing test, we're going to discover just how many of our human friends failed the Turing test. So CS people in this room, raise your hands. Good, okay. So this is your moment. Everybody else, forgive me while I get geeky. The real question to ask, the big, big, big question, this is the mother of all questions, is does P equal NP? And look it up on the web. I'll spare you the, you know, polynomial equal non-polynomial. It's a shorthand of saying, you know, we're surrounded by things every day that are really easy for computers to do and impossible for humans. Calculate pi out 10 places. But there are also things that we do all the time that computers find very, very difficult, like planning your route home while you're doing your shopping. You know, we have approximations to that, but they're common sense things humans do really well that machines cannot do at all. And the philosophical basis, the big question is, those things that computers can't do at all that we find easy are non-polynomial problems. Computers do polynomials really well. And the big question, there's a Nobel Prize in this and probably a new religion as well, is will we reach a day when P equals NP? When computers can solve those problems that are impossible to solve. And then the world really is a different place. But the good news is it's a software problem. And the thing we know about software, you know, someday when I die, I want to die in a software development department because everything there arrives late.
Uh, Okay. Now the question is...
apologies to the CS people in the room.
Well, this one may be geeky too. Please discuss singularity and as a concept and as an institution.
Ah, okay. So singularity is actually a term that was coined by a science fiction writer in San Jose for that moment when machines are smarter than humans and evolving more quickly. And he borrowed from the notion of the singularity of Stephen Hawking. Hawking's description of a black hole is there's an event horizon and everything collapses, you know, in a black hole to a singularity where everything's different and nobody knows what's on the other side. So the idea is when that happens, the whole world has changed and we don't know what's different. And we can't even begin to imagine what it's like. Singularity University, the institution, is, as one of the co-founders, Peter Diamandis, likes to say, neither a university nor is it about the singularity. What Singularity University is about is teaching our students the tools they need to understand exponential change and technology and translate that understanding into a business plan for an organization, whether a company or a foundation, like that could change the lives of 10 to the ninth people in 10 years. And the important part about exponentials is there are exponentials besides, you know, the curve of Moore's law. Our problems are also growing exponentially on this planet, not quite as steeply, but, you know, in nonlinear ways like climate change and the like. And what we have to do is apply exponential thinking to meeting exponential challenges, or the future of humankind will be very short.
So here's a question, coming back now to our local setting. What are the most important connections that CSUMB must make to the local community that can challenge myth and spark innovation?
Well, you know, I've admired CSUMB from afar. This is actually my first time on campus. So actually, you know, a consultant's motto, often mistaken but always certain, the fact that my knowledge is so incomplete probably qualifies to give you advice. You know, I think I think it's about informal connections to the community. That, you know, I've known a fair amount about the formal programs and alliances you're all building, but change happens because of informal connections. A colleague at Berkeley once said about Silicon Valley is, Silicon Valley is not spread out, it's actually very tightly packed. And I think she's right that Silicon Valley works because everybody's jammed in next to everybody else. It's sort of like Venice, where everybody bumped into everyone else. And it's those informal connections that come from deep connections to the rest of the community. So I think just continuing to deepen the informal links to the community, finding, you know, things that are non-obvious, that's the way to make this work. You know, to be intellectual entrepreneurs. And by the way, to not follow his advice too closely, just remember the credo of entrepreneurs is it is always better to ask for forgiveness than for permission. And he's a pretty lenient guy, but it's still better to surprise him from time to time.
Okay, now let me end with this question.
I will not be invited back.
Actually, I do follow that philosophy myself and the CSU system.
Yeah, sorry. Remember that. So when you get, you know, when there's that kind of thing, but you did, yes, no.
So what does it mean to be a futurist, and how do you get to be one?
Yeah, well, the truth is, as I confessed earlier, I have spent my whole career trying not to be called the futurist. I prefer the term forecaster. Futurist is a word with some baggage. I've been accused of being a futurist with a history. My vision about what I do is my job is not to predict outcomes. You know, as that famous American philosopher Yogi Berra said, prediction's really difficult, especially when it's about the future. Well, it's actually not just difficult, it's logically impossible. Think about it. Prediction is only possible in which the future is preordained, the kind of future that only a religious fundamentalist would believe in. And in my professional life, I have seen no evidence that the future is preordained. Our actions in the present determine outcomes in the future. The way to think about the future is a cone of uncertainty extending out from the present. And the uncertainty is intrinsic. And that cone of uncertainty is also the cone of possibility. And when you look into the future, you want to try and define, how broad is that cone? How wide is it? What is in it? What are the possibilities? And how can I lead to actions in the present that will have beneficial outcomes in the future? Being a futurist is applied common sense. Nothing more, nothing less. There's methods to it. I'm actually working on a project now where I'm going back and doing some new mathematical methods. But the tools of forecasting are merely to get one to a point where you have robust, trustworthy intuition about the future. That's the whole point. And by the way, forecasting is not the hard part. Any one of us could sit around a conversation, and probably will outside in a few minutes. You know, I was thinking about this. It's sort of like, you know, the Union Rescue Mission, that there's great food and stuff out there, but you had to listen to the sermon first. The hard part's not the vision of the future. The hard part is not even coming up with the action. The hard part is conviction, developing trustworthy conviction in the face of uncertainty so that you can act decisively. And if we had another couple hours, I'd give you a bunch of examples. But at the end of the day, it's the innovator's conviction to really move in the face of uncertainty. That's the hard part. That's the most important skill you need to develop.
Thank you very much. Please thank me. You. Join me in thanking Paul Schaffer. We have a little present for you here.
Thank you so much. Oh, awesome. Oh, perfect. You all see what it is. It's one of your sweatshirts. It's just the perfect time. It was foggy this morning when I did my run. I will be so cool with this.
Thank you very much. Please join us outside for a reception.